This is the VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump is enthusiastically announcing new action in treating COVID-19 patients.
The FDA has issued an emergency use authorization, and that's such a powerful term, emergency use authorization, for a treatment known as convalescent plasma.
And the president made the announcement at a White House news conference as a breakthrough treatment.
This is a powerful therapy that transfuses very, very strong antibodies from the blood of recovered patients to help treat patients battling a current infection.
The announcement came after White House officials complained there were politically motivated delays by the Food and Drug Administration in approving a vaccine and therapeutics for the disease. India is now leading the world with new coronavirus infections as the country has reached a caseload of over 3 million, AP correspondent Karen Shamas.
The disease has marched through impoverished rural areas in the north and the wealthier but older populations of the south. Health authorities reported over 69,000 new cases, bringing the total to over 3 million. Cases have leveled off in India's two largest cities, Mumbai and Delhi, as new hotspots have emerged in the rural areas of Uttar Pradesh and the country's northern Bihar states, as well as several southern states. India has the third highest caseload after the United States and Brazil. I'm Karen Chamas.
And there are more than 807,000 COVID-19 deaths globally, with more than 176,000 of them in the U.S., followed by Brazil with more than 114,000. The number of global infections is more than 23.3 million. The U.S., Brazil, and India together making up more than half of that. This is VOA News. The white supremacists who slaughtered 51 worshippers at two New Zealand mosques had intended to burn down the mosque afterwards. That's according to a prosecutor in court Monday, while describing two of those praying as making heroic efforts to stop the mass shooting. New details about the March 2019 attacks were outlined during the first day of a four-day sentencing hearing at the Christchurch High Court. The hearing gave some families and survivors their first chance to confront the gunmen. The California wildfires continue to rage on, with more than 1.2 million acres burned and more than 200,000 people affected by evacuations. AP correspondent Julie Walker.
Since mid-August, more than 500 fires have burned throughout the state, says Cal Fire's Bryce Bennett.
It's unprecedented. It's extraordinary. Mother Nature has dealt us a hand here that is pretty incredible that we're adapting to and doing the very best we can to protect life and property.
He says the fires are a result of some of the 12,000 lightning strikes they've had and expect more.
This is a major concern for us because now we have over 13,000 firefighters out on the lines battling these fires in remote areas that should lightning occur, we have to pull back and retreat.
I'm Julie Walker.
Tens of thousands of people rallied in the Belarus capital Sunday and called for President Alexander Lukashenko to resign after disputed election results, a post-election crackdown, and heavy military presence in the city. Protesters, many wearing and waving the opposition's colors of red and white, chanted freedom and we will not forget, we will not forgive as they marched through the city center of Minsk. State media reported about 20,000 protesters took part, but opposition-leaning media put the estimate at nearly 100,000. Demonstrators and demonstrations began after the August 9th election, in which Lukashenko claimed 80% of the vote. The results drew claims of fraud by opposition parties. China has launched the first of four most advanced warships it is building for Pakistan amid the deepening defense and economic ties between the two allied nations. The development comes as both the countries are locked in border tensions with their mutual neighbor, India. The Pakistan Navy said Sunday that a Chinese state-owned shipyard in Shanghai held the launching ceremony for the frigate, with top officials from the service in attendance. The statement did not mention the actual cost of military vessels, but there are reported estimates of more than $350 million each. The Chinese builder is expected to deliver all four units to Pakistan by 2021. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Monday, August 24, and here are some of the stories we are covering. ECOWAS mediators continue their search for a solution to the crisis in Mali.
Everybody knows that we have to find a solution as quick as possible, and we have to find a solution that is accepted by everybody, which is not very easy.
Burkina Faso faces a hunger catastrophe. Tanzania's Human Rights Defenders Coalition suspends operations citing intimidation. And Lesotho's communications minister defends COVID-19 budget expenditures.
I can't argue with somebody who has written an article who did not make thorough research. What I'm telling you is that a lot has been done. Go and get the report from UNDP about educating Basotho with COVID-19.
Tesele Masaribane is the Lesotho's communications minister, and Africare is now Pan-Africare. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Economic Community of West Africans, this ECOWAS, continued its mediation efforts over the weekend to find a solution to the political crisis in Mali. Chief mediator and former Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, said in a tweet on Saturday that ECOWAS will continue to engage all stakeholders until a lasting peace is found. Senegalese human rights activist Ibrahim Akan has two pieces of advice for ECOWAS. First, Khan says ECOWAS should realize that it cannot prescribe solutions to the Mali crisis against the will of the population there. With the possibility of crisis in Guinea and Ivory Coast on the horizon, Khan also says ECOWAS needs to be proactive to avert future crises.
Since their arrival, the ECOWAS team, which is a very high-level team because it's composed of former President Goodluck Jonathan, but also the chairperson of the ECOWAS Commission, the whole idea was to meet with many stakeholders, but this time they even extended the discussion to the ambassadors accredited in Mali from ECOWAS countries, the discussion with MINUSMA, the discussion with the people who were arrested, and the discussion with some institutions such as the Constitutional Court. And I think even today, there was a tweet coming from the chairperson of the commission who was really pleased that he has met with President Ibeka and some people who were arrested. And I think all those elements helped to make the situation far better than the one that we had on Friday or on Thursday. So now everybody knows that we have to find a solution as quick as possible, and we have to find a solution that is accepted by everybody, which is not very easy.
Former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, who is the lead ECOWAS mediator, said over the weekend that ECOWAS will continue to engage the Malian stakeholders until lasting peace is found. Do you think that it is possible that when this lasting peace comes, that President Keita can be allowed to return to power?
I don't think Keita coming back to power is a solution to the current situation of Mali. First, he has resigned, even if you are resigned under the pressure of the military, but he has formally resigned. And even the decree that he adopted dissolving the parliament and the government are now published. For me, what is really critical at the moment, how in this particular context where the military said they have not organized a coup, they have not suspended the constitution, but at the same time, there is no president, there is no parliament, how we can ensure a kind of continuity of the state and make sure that the state comes back to a normal constitutional order. The only institution that can help for that is the Constitutional Court of Mali.
It seems that the fires in Mali may not be the last one that ECOWAS will have to put out. We were talking the other day about Guinea and Ivory Coast. What lessons do you think ECOWAS can draw from the Malian situation?
Two or three things. Even if you want to maintain and to uphold the legal order in the region, you need to uphold it by bringing the population there. You cannot take those kind of decisions against the will of the population. The second lesson I think that needs to be learned is that ECOWAS needs to be very proactive. They should not wait until the situation is completely tense so that they come and trying to sort out the problem. No, Guinea, we know that the elections are in October. Something needs to be done from now. The same in Cote d'Ivoire. And also start looking at other situations where elections are going to take place and where probably there will be tension between the opposition and the running government to try to find solution to them.
Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese human rights activist. He was speaking with us from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. The former chairperson of Lesotho's National Emergency Command Center, or the NECC, the body set up to coordinate the government's response to COVID-19, has been defending the way that the budget was used. Minister of Communication, Science and Technology, Tesele Maseribane, who chaired the NECC before it was disbanded in June this year, says everything was done by the book. His defense comes after the Lesotho Times reported that the NECC lavishly spent on food for its officials while health workers had no personal protective equipment or PPEs. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned over the weekend that to him, PPE's corruption is actually murder. Minister Maseribane says the command center, which comprised several Lesotho government ministries, arranged for planes from China to deliver PPEs to Basotho.
I was the chairperson of the cabinet subcommittee, compromised with about 13 to 14 ministries. Ministry of Health was there with his PS, and the whole ministry structure was also represented at the command center. Minister of Home Affairs with the Principal Secretary of Home Affairs and the Director, even the Deputy Principal Secretary. The Government Secretary was also part of the Command Center. It did not have powers. The Cabinet had powers to make decisions. We would recommend to the Cabinet what has been advised by the Advisory Committee, which was all technical people from all different sectors of the government of Lesotho.
There is an article in the Lesotho Times suggesting that the NECC became an extravagant institution concerned about the well-being of its officials instead of focusing on its mandate to fight the coronavirus pandemic. Your response, please.
Well, James, you journalists are journalists. And in Lesotho, I don't think the country is what I can call high-level journalists. They put my face in front, and they're talking about financial matters. They're not talking about my position as a chair who was chairing the cabinet subcommittee. They're putting financial matters, which Minister of Finance was there, which the Auditor General was there. Everybody that was running finance sector was there. They put my face in front, and they say the command center did not focus. Look, first of all, we drafted regulations. We drafted protocols. We coordinated the whole country. We issued operations to secure all borders. We came with the master plan within the command center. Everybody was there. Every sector, every ministry did its own responsibility, its constitutional mandate to do. We coordinated the private sector. We coordinated the NGOs. We coordinated the lockdowns that we used to have. And the only problem that we needed to finalize was restructuring and supporting the most important sector, which is Ministry of Health.
The article is suggesting here that much money was spent without focusing on protective equipment for responders and also a campaign to fight the virus.
I can't argue with somebody who has written an article who did not make thorough research. What I'm telling you is that a lot has been done. Go and get the report from UNDP about educating Basotho with COVID-19. Go and get the report from UNDP on education material that we took out to the countryside. Go to an independent organization or any institution. Go and make a research with the NGOs about making campaign on education. They were behind that. And we did welcome their mission as NGOs of Lesotho, that they want to go and campaign and teach Basotho about COVID-19. We gave the media of Lesotho, as Minister of Communication, free airtime to run COVID-19. Free, all media, not national media. So somebody does not want to do a research. It's just they want to sell a paper. The issue of PPE, it is within the Ministry of Health that the budget was there. But there are cases where people stole the PPE. We arranged planes to come from China to Lesotho to bring PPE so that we can give it to all districts. But it was not enough. Even now, We don't even have enough PPE.
Tesele Maseribane is Lesotho's communications minister and former chairperson of that country's National Emergency Command Center. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. The World Food Program says Burkina Faso is facing an acute shortage of food, with more than 3.2 million people going hungry in the conflict-ridden country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
There's been a 50% rise in the number of people struggling to feed themselves and their families since March. The World Food Program warns the situation is likely to worsen in the current lean season, the period when food stocks are at their lowest ahead of the September harvest. WFP reports people in two provinces in the Sahel region, Oudalan and Soum, have reached near starvation level. It says fighting by a myriad of jihadist and armed groups in the region has forced thousands of people to flee their homes, preventing them from cultivating their crops. WFP spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers says insecurity and conflict are the main drivers of growing hunger in Burkina Faso.
Most of those forced to flee are subsistence farmers and livestock herders who have had to abandon their farms, homes, assets, livelihoods. Some farmers were not able to harvest their field, and most of the displaced are no longer able to grow crops. This is a dramatic in a country where 80% of the population lives from agriculture.
The United Nations reports a surge of attacks by armed groups over the last 2 years has prompted more than 1 million people in Burkina Faso to flee their homes. Beers says WFP is racing against the clock to prevent a hunger catastrophe. She says the agency has continued to scale up its assistance over the past 2 years to try to keep pace with the growing humanitarian crisis. She says WFP is hoping to provide food assistance to 1.2 million people this month, but money is running out. She says the agency urgently needs $51 million to respond to the growing needs. She warns WFP will be forced to cut food rations without immediate funding, putting many lives at risk. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, August 24. AfriCare, one of the largest African-American-led nonprofit international development organizations, has ceased to operate. As of July 2020, AfriCare was replaced by a new autonomous organization called Pan-AfriCare, with headquarters in Dakar, Senegal. At its pinnacle, AfriCare, founded in 1970, delivered more than $1 billion in assistance to tens of millions in Africa. Robert Mallet, president and CEO, says Pan-AfriCare will continue to do some of the same work that AfriCare was doing, as well as initiate its own programs to benefit people in Africa. He says the one big difference is that Pan-AfriCare will be headquartered in Dakar, Senegal, in line with the trend that solutions to most problems are mainly local.
Pan-AfriCare will continue in many ways the mission of AfriCare. It will assume responsibility for managing all of our wonderful programs on the continent. Just in this past year alone, in 2019, AfriCare served over a million people, farmers, children, women, youth, patients in a variety of different areas. Pan-AfriCare will continue to do that. It's going to be working initially in seven countries. That would include Burkina Faso, Angola, Chad, Kenya, Zimbabwe, Senegal, and will continue to do some of the work that AfriCare has done there.
When you say that Pan-AfriCare is or will be an autonomous Africa-based and led international organization, what exactly do you mean?
The one big difference is Pan-AfriCare will be headquartered in Dakar, Senegal. So the huge difference is that we are moving management control and direction of the organization to the continent itself. That is in keeping with lots of trends where many organizations are, quote, going local. We believe that not only is it time to do that, but we have developed over the years of AfriCare's existence many development professionals who can handle these programs. We have wonderful country directors and staff in all of the countries that we work in now. and they're able to carry forth these programs. What that will help us to do is save some money. We don't have to support a U.S.-based operation. That goes away. We are local. We are closer to the people that we serve in terms of management, direction, and control. AfriCare was founded to improve the lives of Africans. Pan-AfriCare will do likewise. In addition, one of the core values we have is that we design our efforts in concert with the people we serve, that solutions to problems are mainly local, and that we will continue to pay attention to a local approach to solving problems. That's one of our core values. We also believe that Africans serve Africans.
Mr. Malo, what would be the main source of funding for Pan-AfriCare? As I was telling you, as a young reporter, we used to cover AfriCare's annual fundraising dinner here in Washington.
I don't know what the leadership of Pan-AfriCare will decide to do to supplement its income from its projects. Obviously, they will continue to compete for grants from multilateral organizations such as the World Bank, such as the Global Fund. They'll continue to compete for USAID and grants from the United States and other European countries. The Grand Challenges grants, as well as from foundations, from the Gates Foundation, Dangote Foundation, and other places. We have created also a Friends of Pan-AfriCare organization based here in the United States, which we hope, when fully launched, will be used to raise money for organizations who share the mission of AfriCare.
Robert Mallett is president and CEO of Pan-AfriCare. You're speaking with us from Washington, D.C. A week ago, the Tanzania Human Rights Defenders Coalition, the THRDC, suspended its operations in the country due to what the group referred to as intimidation and meddling by security forces. Tanzania's Electoral Commission also disqualified the group from its list of organizations authorized to provide voters education and monitor the country's October 2020 elections. In June this year, the THRDC announced that it has received a grant of 277 million shillings, about $2.5 million, from one of its donors for protection of human rights defenders and journalists ahead of the Tanzania elections. Anna Alois Henga is executive director of the Legal and Human Rights Center, the LHRC, of Tanzania, an affiliate of the THRDC.
No, it's not us who suspended the operation. It's a sister organization called Tanzania Human Rights Defenders Coalition. We didn't suspend our operation, but we are members of that coalition.
So you are a member of the Tanzania Human Rights Coalition. So are your operations also suspended?
No, we are continuing as usual. It's only the coalition secretariat which has been suspended.
Why did they suspend your operations?
What they're going to do is to freeze their bank account. When they went to ask, they were told you did not comply with the recent NGO regulation. The regulations require organizations to send the donor quota to the public and also to send to Treasury. So they are told that you did not comply to that. When they reported to the police, the CEO of the coalition was arrested for some hours and was released on bail for non-compliance of the regulations. Later on, the Inspector General of Police responded that they freeze their account because they fear maybe there's something fishy with their account because they received a huge amount of money, more than 6 billion Tanzanian shillings. I know there are a lot of issues of intimidation, the shielding space, it's happening. So it might be just excuse to make sure they are not operating freely.
You alluded to intimidation, and somebody mentioned the other day also that this might be government meddling or intimidation.
You know, we are heading to 2020 general election in October. So any voice which is coming up is being silenced. They started with political parties, the vocal political parties, political parties to the media. You heard about the media being shut down, being fined. You heard about international media like BBC and the Voice of America and VOA. You cannot operate freely radios here in Tanzania. Then they came to see civil organizations, two individuals. Well, every voice which is coming up is being silenced or intimidated so that you remain silent. This is our new normal now.
I was reading that the Electoral Commission bar or prevented the Human Rights Defenders Coalition from carrying out voter education. What does your organization do, and are you part of that? Are you being able to be involved in the electoral process?
We've been banned. We also begin to receive accreditation to observe the elections. Other organizations have been accredited. I think they do that one. But our organization, the National Defenders, Legal and Human Rights Center, all the big organizations and experienced in the organizations with integrity have not been accredited.
So your organization will not be able to be involved in voter matters during the electoral process. You will not.
We are not
accredited,
so we cannot.
Anna Alois Henga is Executive Director of Legal and Human Rights Center of Tanzania. She was speaking with us from the capital, Dar es Salaam. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the UEFA Champions League final as Bayern Munich sealed a sixth European Cup crown on Sunday night with a narrow 1-0 win over first-time finalist Paris Saint-Germain in Lisbon. Bayern's Kingsley Coman, who started his career at PSG, settled a tightly contested Champions League final with a 59th-minute header at the far post from Joshua Kimmich's cross to leave the French giants still searching for that elusive Champions League triumph. The German giants were favorites coming into the contest, and they duly completed a record full house of 11 Champions League victory without dropping any match this term. Back here on the African continent, Zamalek produced what might be their best league performance this season to defeat arch rivals Al Ahly 3-1 in match day 21 of the 2019-2020 Egyptian Premier League at the Cairo International Stadium on Saturday. The famous Cairo Derby ended in favor of Zamalek as they emerged victorious over their bitterest rivals. Zamalek raised their tally to 42 points, 14 shy of league leaders Al Ahly, who had their first defeat of the season. And now to some boxing news. Russia was announced earlier in the year as the first country to host the new format of the AIBA Team World Cup in 2020. The final has been tentatively fixed to hold in October 2020 in the city of Nizhny Novgorod. The best national teams from all over the world are expected to take part in this edition. Uganda is sending a 20-strong contingent of male and female boxers to the tournament. Moses Muhanji is the president of the Uganda Boxing Federation.
Now the winners will be picking some good sums of money, which they can come back with the country on top of the medals. And beyond that, also exposing the athletes to the world market, because we don't only go to these tournaments just to compete for medals and cash. We're also trying to expose our athletes so they can be identified by international promoters, so they can be able to further their careers into something else.
In cricket news, Faf du Plessis, South Africa's Test and T20I captain until February this year, has admitted to having got it wrong before as he, alongside Dwayne Pretorius, Rassie van de Dusen, Anrich Notchi, and Marizane Kapp, became the first members of the White Afrikaans cricket community in South Africa to publicly voice their support for the Black Lives Matter movement, joining Lungi Ngindi and 32 other players and 5 current coaches of color. South Africa's sports minister, Nathi Ntutwa, had told Cricket South Africa that racism in the sport will not be tolerated by government and instructed the federation to deal with the systemic racism that has and continues to be highlighted by former players.
It is now time to act, and we want people to move, and if they don't move, we are going to help them to move.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, August 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butt in Washington, hoping that you will have a productive week.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clott, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2